Forever Girl, a Hamilton Spectator serial podcast.
And the murder of a child, as senseless and as horrific as it is, I think that's going to impact any investigator. It'll impact any human.
The tiny skeleton was discovered by a Hamilton man who was walking through the woods Wednesday afternoon.
I think it was a scary time. And that was, you didn't expect anything like that to ever happen.
She told me when she was dying, I don't know if she told you, but she told me when she was dying, I will send you a message when I find out who did this.
It's a small square stone, and it reads, "In loving memory of Cindy Williams, January 20, 1970, to July 26, 1974, always remembered." And there's an inscription of an angel on the stone.
My name is John Wells, and I'm a reporter with the Hamilton Spectator. Writing long feature stories about Hamilton murder cases, which often entails speaking with families of victims, and on occasion, killers, is something I never enter into lightly. But I think these stories can have a positive impact, especially those involving an unsolved homicide. Maybe that impact is subtle, just ripples, so that maybe it was better, all things considered, to tell the story rather than not tell it at all. At least that's what I told myself when I started working on a piece that I've titled The Forever Girl. I first heard of her 11 summers ago in 2005 when I was researching a series for The Spectator called Postmortem, which was the story about a murdered woman's skeletal remains found in a field in Flamborough. The lead Hamilton detective on the case, Paul LaHaye, took me on a tour of the homicide department at Central Station. Seemingly in passing, he showed me a binder containing a list of cold cases. Among them was the case of the little blonde-haired girl, 4-year-old Cindy Williams. There is a difference between cold cases and unsolved cases. An unsolved case can be an active investigation, that is, work is still being done on it. The Audrey Gleave case, the Joe Mello case, these are Hamilton unsolved homicides I've written about, where police are actively, if sporadically, depending on competing cases, working on them. The Spectator typically runs a story once a year where Hamilton police list their unsolved cases, many with outstanding reward money. But some cases are so cold that they never get mentioned. Leads have been exhausted, suspects and witnesses have either died or still aren't talking. So Paul LaHaye showed me that name, Cindy Williams. The date was 1974. "See that?" he said. "Cute little girl, 4 years old, no one ever caught." It got to him, he said, even though he never worked the case. He seemed to get choked up just mentioning it. Looking back on that moment, while LaHaye was sincere in his reaction, he was also clearly floating the case my way in the hope that I might write about Cindy someday, maybe try to revive interest in the case being solved. I pulled a brown file folder from the Spectator's homicide files with the name Cindy Williams on it. It sat on my desk several years. And then, early last year, I did some quick research and found a number for Cindy's lone sibling, a sister, Michelle, who lives a few hours from Hamilton. She was surprised to hear from a reporter. She also didn't want to talk about her murdered little sister from more than 40 years ago, or at least that was my impression. I didn't press it. I have written about adults bludgeoned to death, poisoned, shot, and even dismembered, but I have not written about a child being abducted and killed. I wasn't sure I wanted to. I put Cindy Williams on the back burner. The story stayed there until last fall. A Hamilton woman named Kathy Horvath emailed me on October 4th, 2015. She said that she'd been reading my book, Postmortem, and came across a brief reference I wrote in that story, quoting a Hamilton police officer who mentioned the Cindy Williams cold case. "Well done, Detective LaHaye," I thought. Cindy, Kathy said, was her niece. Kathy had been 13 in the summer of 1974 when Cindy went missing. Kathy wrote in the email, "I often wonder what really happened to my beautiful, funny, precocious little niece, Cindy Williams. A day does not go by that I don't think about that time and wonder who was responsible for her death. I would be grateful if you could contact me to discuss how I would go about reopening her case. At home, I pulled a novel off my bookshelf called White Jazz by the hard-boiled mystery writer James Ellroy. In the introduction, he writes, "All I have is the will to remember." I reopened that brown file folder in my desk. Black and white newspaper clippings from 1974. Little girl on a beach, hugging a teddy bear. Spectator reporters had shown up at the family's door back then. These were the pictures the family had given us to publish to help find her. A big Spectator headline, July 27, 1974. Hundreds comb mountain for child missing all night. The photo showed cops and members of the public gathering to form a search party. The story read, quote, "More than 100 searchers were up at dawn today looking for a pretty 4-year-old girl missing since yesterday near the precipitous edge of Hamilton's eastern mountain brow," unquote. There were no Amber Alerts back then, no social media, no internet at all. And that mention of the edge of the mountain, in retrospect, it sounds almost naive that the speculation and fear early on was that she'd fallen down the escarpment and that it had not been something unimaginably dark that had claimed her. I was struck also by the use of her first name in all the coverage. The journalistic convention was, and still is for the most part, that we use last names of people in stories, unless they are children. And so it was, "Cindy has gone missing. The search for Cindy continues. She was not Williams. She was a little girl and would forever be that way." Headline: Canada-wide appeal launched for Cindy. Headline: Cindy is reported seen in the north. Back then, a nationwide search would not be nearly as sophisticated and effective as it is today. Police services didn't even have fax machines, much less email, and certainly primitive databases compared to today. Today, what, if anything, would police have to say about the case today, I wondered. And what about Kathy Horvath's hope that the case would be reopened? I put in a call to the homicide unit at Hamilton Police, and I booked an interview with Kathy, Cindy's aunt, and the sister of Cindy's mother, Diane Williams. We decided on January 20th. That night, I parked across the street from her home on the East Mountain. It was dark and cold and starting to snow. Inside, I met with Kathy and also a woman named Cynthia Wilson Shepherd. Cynthia had been close friends with Cindy's mother, Diane. That's how the little girl got her name. They talked a lot about Diane and the Williams family roots. Diane and Kathy's family was from England, from Guernsey, one of the English Channel Islands. Diane was born there, along with her older brother, Jeff. Kathy was born when the family moved to Canada, and another sibling, Shelley. Once settled in Hamilton in the 1950s, Diane's parents, Ron and Gwen Williams, became devout Jehovah's Witness. As a teenager in the early 60s, Diane rebelled in the way she dressed, and she smoked, and she dated an older guy who worked at a Fasco and drove an MGB. At 20, she became pregnant and had a daughter, who she named Michelle. 4 years later, 1970, she had a second child. That was Cindy. Neither of those two fathers stayed with Diane or knew the girls. Diane was disfellowshipped, as it was called, by elders in the Jehovah's Witness congregation, and also by her own parents, who refused to talk or even look at Diane. In fact, they ostracized her the rest of her life. In 1974, Diane, 4-year-old Cindy, and Cindy's adoptive father, a man named John Cherwadi, lived in apartment 402 at 1165 Fennell Avenue East, along with Cindy's older sister, Michelle. That summer, on July 26th, a humid and drizzly day, Cindy asked if she could go upstairs and play at her friend's apartment, one floor above. The routine was that Cindy could go up by herself and come back on her own as well. She did this all the time. Cindy was a child who was always on the move, getting into mischief. That's what I was told during an interview I had with Teresa and Debbie Cherwadi, who were, back then, teenage daughters of John's, who often visited with Cindy and at the Fennell Avenue apartment.
Well, she was fun. She was a little imp.
She was trouble.
She, she definitely moved to the beat of her own drum. Mm-hmm. Didn't like the word no. Didn't listen all that well. Mm-hmm. But then she'd just grin at you and you'd forget what the hell you were mad about in the first place. She was always constantly in motion. Mm-hmm. Liked to climb. She was a monkey.
Was letting Cindy move around in that apartment building by herself at 4 years old too much freedom? In the early 1970s, this was not beyond the pale. It was a different time. The days when young kids walked to school and played outside without adults around, so long as they were in by dark, maybe. Wearing a helmet, riding a bike, was not even a consideration. Abduction, or what was then called kidnapping, was not unheard of course. In 1967, the case of the disappearance of young Marianne Schuett in Burlington had haunted people familiar with the case, and she was never found. But a child being snatched away was mostly a dark abstraction, something that would never happen to your own loved one. I told Kathy and Cynthia that for me, it all brought back one of my oldest memories from around 1973 when I was six and our family lived in Montreal. My parents let me get rides home from school from the milkman. I still remember how the glass bottles rattled as we drove up the hill to our home. My mother recoils at that memory now. What were they thinking, she says. But back then it wasn't unusual. For Diane Williams, letting her daughter Cindy have the freedom to roam in their apartment building, however, haunted her the rest of her life.
From kindergarten, I used to get rides home from the milkman.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he'd come in his truck, the milkman truck. Yeah. I remember the rattling bottles.
I used to go to school on a milk thing up to Barton.
My mom says now, just a horrible, you know, nowadays, you wouldn't trust it.
I remember Diane saying that after Cindy was taken, she would, you know, she'd go to the store and people would point at her and she'd hear them whispering what a horrible mother she was because she didn't watch her daughter.
So on that afternoon, July 26th, 1974, after leaving to go play with her friend upstairs, Cindy did not return to the apartment. Diane and daughter Michelle and John Trawadi, who had arrived home from work, banged on doors. The parents of the playmate upstairs, Cindy had gone to see, said their family had been at the dentist that afternoon. No one was at home to answer if Cindy came knocking. Kathy and Cynthia told me.
Diane lived on the end of the hall. Mm-hmm. And there was a little girl upstairs or downstairs?
Upstairs
that she would, you know, just go upstairs.
It's her friend.
And frame and play there. Mm-hmm. And then at dinner time, Diane would call and say, it's time for dinner. Mm-hmm. And I think the little girl used to come down too. Like they took turns.
Yeah, they took turns. Mm-hmm.
And one day, this day, she went off to this friend and Diane called around lunchtime, I guess, and said,
because Diane's down in the apartment. Doing whatever, hanging out,
And she said, can you tell Cindy to come home?
On the phone.
Yeah. And she said she hadn't been here all day.
By 4:30 p.m., Diane had called Hamilton Police and the search was on. Search parties combing the area, up and down the escarpment, sometimes in dangerously steep locations, and going door to door in neighborhoods. 2 months passed. In October, desperate, Diane saw a psychic near Kitchener. A Spectator reporter named Arnie Hakala went with Diane to witness the reading. Diane cried when the psychic said she believed Cindy was dead. The psychic told her, quote, I don't think he took her west. I think he went west afterwards. He didn't travel a long distance. He's sly, unquote. Kathy repeated to me the hope she had expressed by email, a highly optimistic one, I thought, that police might look at the case again. The OPP held jurisdiction over the case all these years later. Kathy had put a call in to them, and so had I, exchanging emails with a PR official a few hours before coming to see Kathy that night. The official told me the OPP had no comment about the case of any kind. It would not even talk about whether it had ever been revisited in the past, much less whether it would be revisited in the future.
It's interesting to say about the OPP. I was just emailing today with a guy at the OPP, like a communications person.
Right.
And I was asking him if
you know, if the case had ever been reopened or what the status was, kind of thing. And he said, you know, there was no one active on the file right now, right. Which isn't surprising, I guess, given how old it is. But he went in and told me, he said, well, you know, can you tell, because, you know, there were a bunch of cases back in the late 90s, early 2000s that were reopened. It was called Project Angel.
Yeah, Project Angel.
You've heard of that?
From London, right?
Yeah, the London area.
Yeah, Angel Network.
And because with DNA and things like that, they reopened a lot of these cases. And so I asked him, was hers reopened as part of that, even though it's not London,
right.
It's not too far. And so they had this policy of reopening cases with DNA and so on. And but he wouldn't even tell me that. He said, oh, did maintain the investigative integrity? And I said, well, I'm not sure why that's an issue, just to tell me whether or not it was ever reopened or not. But from what you're saying, they were trying to.
As sometimes happens, I was so frustrated by that roadblock that I wanted to dig harder as a result of his stonewalling. But it did seem like a dead end. It was getting late that night. I had been with Kathy and Cynthia nearly 3 hours. They seemed determined women, driven to find some measure of justice for Cindy, and I admired them for it. I thanked them for their time and asked if at some point they would show me Cindy's grave. They said they would. Outside, I scraped ice off my car and got inside, waiting for it to warm. Here we go again, I thought, the wheels turning on another murder story, and I felt the familiar mix of curiosity, tentative enthusiasm, and regret. I stopped for a slice of pizza on Fennel East, not all that far from where Cindy had lived. A young woman serving me smiled a lot and joked with me about something or other, and it felt good. Late that night, I checked my email before going to bed. There was a message from Kathy. It had just occurred to her, she wrote, that today's date, our random interview appointment, January 20th, was Cindy's birthday. 2 weeks later, Kathy Horvath sent me another email. She had received a call back from the OPP. A detective had agreed to meet with her.